this 15th edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the second half of Chapter 7, which is titled Human Life. Mind is the next aspect on which I want to elaborate. I've often wondered where mind stops and spirit begins, where mind itself began. I think it comes with us to our physical body, though there is much in the physical brain that has to be learned to get the body up and running. Consider watching a baby learning to walk. That child is actively, though subconsciously, programming his brain for the lifelong task of mobility. It's a fascinating process when one considers what is going on, largely on autopilot, instinct as it were. Psychologist Carl Jung sees a conflict between mind and heart. He would call it a subconscious or a dream state. In his book, Modern Man in Search of a Soul, previously cited, he writes of this conflict, quote, "The dream gives a true picture of the subjective state, while the conscious mind denies that this state exists or recognizes it only grudgingly. When in such cases we listen to the dictates of the conscious mind, we are always in doubt," end quote, page 5. Further on, Jung writes, page 11, "One thing we ought never to forget, almost the half of our lives is passed in a more or less unconscious state. The dream is specifically the utterance of the unconscious. It is highly probable that the unconscious psyche contains a wealth of contents and living forms equal to or even greater than does consciousness." End quote. Perhaps it is this dream state spirit consciousness that the past life regression hypnosis taps into. More on that later. Karl Popper, Conjectures and Refutations, previously cited, also compares the mind-spirit combination in these words. Quote, "Thus we are split into a human part, we ourselves the part which is the source of our fallible opinions, doxa, of our errors and of our ignorance, and a superhuman part, such as the senses or the intellect, the part which is the source of real knowledge, episteme, and which has an almost divine authority over us," page 17. Most people, myself included, say dreams are such a mishmash of weirdness and images that there is nothing contained in them of value. Jung, who used a dream analysis in his therapy, claims different. Quote, "No amount of skepticism and critical reserve has ever enabled me to regard dreams as negligible occurrences. Often enough they appear senseless, but it is obviously we who lack the sense and the ingenuity to read the enigmatical message from the nocturnal realm of the psyche," end quote, page 15. Think of the dreams of Joseph in the book of Genesis, chapters 40 through 41, and how those dreams saved Egypt from starvation in an upcoming famine. Jung says, "Since half of our lives are devoted to this subconscious state known as sleep, there must be something going on there, else why would evolution cause us to waste all that energy?" Jung says, page 16, "People have been caused to make a dangerous monster out of the unconscious, that really very natural thing, as if all that is good, reasonable, beautiful, and worth living for had taken up its abode in consciousness. Have the horrors of the world war really not opened our eyes? Are we still unable to see that man's conscious mind is even more devilish and perverse than the unconscious?" Eben Alexander, a very accomplished and qualified neuroscientist and surgeon, is in a prime position to analyze the brain in relation to a spiritual reality he visited during a near-death experience. I'll have to quote locations instead of page numbers here. I'm reading it on my Kindle. "In a sense, functioning with our mortal temporal brains is like doing math by scratching in the dirt with a stick compared to the computer that our spirit brain is, but there are good reasons for the primacy of this primitive brain in the here and now." Alexander writes, quote, Just as most of ordinary life holds too much information for us to take in at once and still get anything done, being excessively conscious of the world beyond the here and now would slow down our progress even more. If we knew too much of the spiritual realm now, then navigating our lives on Earth would be an even greater challenge than it already is. Location 1105. For the purposes of getting things done, for example, the business of our temporal mortal lives, the spirit brain has to take a back seat, subconscious. He continues, quote, "That's not to say we shouldn't be conscious of the world beyond now, only that if we are extra conscious of their grandeur and immensity, they can prevent action while still here on Earth," end quote. If I remember correctly, Betty Eady, a near-death author, quoted extensively in these pages, had problems readjusting to the mortal norm when she returned from her near-death experience. The infant's programming of his brain for mobility I see as a manifestation of the pre-existent schooling or instinct instilled in the spirit that has to come to this mortal body so that it can survive in this temporal world. In that respect, at least, I would say that the human aspect of mind was with us before we were born. The brain grew in the fetus as a machine is put together to take advantage of the mind's learning, just as computers are built to handle software. Sometimes the brain, through birth defects, is faulty, even to the point of unworkability. I've had friends with cerebral palsy in varying degrees. It's frustrating for them. Their minds want their bodies to perform certain tasks, but they can't. For some reason, the connection between mind and body is short-circuited. Let's compare the mind-body, or soul, spirit-heart relationship to a computer setup of printer, computer, and software. There's a printer, or some other form of robotics, which receives instructions from the computer and performs a task. The printer is the body, or the soul. It is generally mindless in that it does things only as it is told by the brain and has no morality or volition on its own, only answering the basic needs of survival such as breathing, eating, drinking, reproducing, and the like. The computer part is our brain, which interprets instructions from the software, or the mind of our spirit, bringing with it the education of the premortal life. The computer does have some pre-programming and can function without software. I play solitaire on it when I get writer's block, for example. Of course, this is software put into the computer at purchase, so this metaphor doesn't exactly fit. The brain, or perhaps the right temporal lobe, is a link between the infinite and the finite, part mind and part spirit. And Dr. Melvin Morse has written a whole book, Where God Lives, The Science of the Paranormal and How Our Brains Are Linked to the Universe, discussing this idea, at least as far as I can interpret it. I don't want to misinterpret the good doctor's efforts, especially out of gratitude for the many things he's taught me relating to near-death experiences and the human situation. It seems from the book that our mind, or the right temporal lobe of the brain, is capable of linking to the information of the cosmos. Sir John Eccles was a Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist who studied consciousness. He proposed that consciousness may actually exist apart from the brain. Eccles once stated, quote, "I maintain that the human mystery is incredibly demeaned by scientific reductionism, with its claim in promissory materialism to account eventually for all of the spirit world in terms of patterns and neuronal activity. This belief must be classified as a superstition. We have to recognize that we are spiritual beings with souls existing in a spiritual world, as well as material beings with bodies and brains existing in a material world." End quote. As quoted in Evidence of the Afterlife, Jeffrey Long and Paul Perry, page 103. I believe we can see the universe as a great internet of information, a cosmos-wide web, or CWW, as opposed to our world-wide web, or www. I might add in passing that those who in this life make the web an insecure and tricky place to conduct the most innocent of affairs, will they be allowed access to this cosmos-wide web when they pass on? Bad enough to screw up the World Wide Web with some kind of virus, I'm sure they won't be allowed to screw up the whole cosmos web until, through a massive change of personality and attitude, they're finally allowed access to it. My Kindle functions by tapping into the cloud. My computer nerd middle son, Justin, talks of cloud computing. I'm certainly not a tech guru. I'll leave that up to Craig and Kate Whitmore. But isn't this cloud computing we're currently functioning with a Plato's cave analog for the universal cosmos web, as it were? More and more, I think the things we come up with here are remnants of memories of what we had there. Plato's cave. Morse writes, quote, "We are in constant communication with the information contained in the universal memory. Some of these memories are so dominant that many people have access to them." In this book, page 51, he writes of people having near-death experiences where the ability to process memories seems to increase the closer they come to death. Quote, "Memories might return because the right temporal lobe is activated at the point of death, which causes it to link to a universal memory bank, one that possibly exists outside the body." One child who had a near-death experience was interviewed by Morse and said, "I went out there where everything is. I could see everything and talk to everything because it's all around us all the time. We just can't see it most of the time." Page 94. In his book, Proof of God, surgeon Eben Alexander gives much the same light on this knowledge milieu that spirits seem to be marinating in. Quote, "Up there, a question would arise in my mind, and the answer would arise at the same time, like a flower coming up right next to it. It was almost as if, just as no physical particle in the universe is really separate from another, so in the same way, there was no such thing as a question without an accompanying answer. These answers were not simple yes or no fair either. They were vast conceptual edifices, staggering structures of living thought, as intricate as cities, ideas so vast that they would have taken me lifetimes to find my way around if I had been confined to earthly thought." Location 1131. A few years back, there was a big stir over the God spot in our brains, apparently a part of our right temporal lobe that seems hardwired to receive spiritual communications. In the foreword to Betty Eady's book, Embraced by the Light, previously cited, Dr. Morse writes, "We have even documented an area in the brain which allows us to have the experience, the near-death experience. That means that near-death experiences are absolutely real and not hallucinations of the mind. They are as real as any other human capability. They are as real as math, as real as language." Roman numeral 8 in the introduction. In another book by Morse, Transformed by the Light, he pursues the phenomena of the right temporal lobe just above the right ear and buried in that area of the brain. Quote, "It is the circuit board of mysticism. This is the area responsible for complex language, self-consciousness, long-term planning, daydreams, and soulful thought. It is also our link to consciousness, our link to the divine. One thing is certain, though. People who lose this area to surgery or brain damage become soulless automatons who act like zombies." Page 145. He also identifies this area, probably, as the place where near-death experiences take place. Page 195. As to it being involved in the near-death experience, Morse says, page 200, quote, "As the brain is dying, portions of the right temporal lobe start to work properly for the first time. The fact that it is processing memory into our long-term memory banks shows that it is working very well." It does seem that the brain is a link between our spirit selves or the education we received in the premortal existence and our current mortal life. I think the mind is called upon to do a delicate balancing act between the two forces, the forces of the spirit, heart, and body, soul, or as described above, the spirit materiality versus the temporal materiality. Morse does say, quote, "The right temporal lobe picks up energy patterns and interprets them. These patterns seem to contain the code for spiritual experiences and communications with other realities." Page 77, Where God Lives. Many are the descriptions of the spiritual cosmos as a realm of energy and our initial existence as the same substance. If the right temporal lobe has the ability to pick up and interpret these things, however faulty in our current mortal state, then there must be some reason for it beyond this pale of material reality. There certainly would have been no reason for us to acquire these abilities through evolution if a spiritual energy cosmos didn't exist, and there was nothing there to contact and interpret. In Memories of God and Creation, previously cited by Shakuntala Modi, M.D., also defines this right brain, left brain differentiation. Quote, "The conscious mind is the thinking, reasoning, and problem-solving part of our mind, also known as the left brain. It is the part of our mind that deals with day-to-day functioning. It is the normal state of our awareness. The subconscious mind functions at a deeper level than our conscious mind and is known as the right brain. It deals with memories, intuition, and knowledge." End quote. Through hypnotic therapy, Modi taps into the premortal existent memories of his patients and reports, quote, "The subconscious mind is, in fact, our soul. For purposes of this discussion, I'd use the term spirit or heart, and hopefully not greatly distort Modi's meanings, which contains all the memories from the beginning of time. Everything that has ever happened to us is recorded in our subconscious mind, the mind of the spirit, from this life and all other lives since the beginning of time," pages 3 through 5, "and can be brought out by past life regression hypnosis. Quote, every human being and every human mind has roots that extend indefinitely far back through time. The genes that regulate all aspects of our physical development, including the prenatal fabrication of our brains, were in existence long before we or our parents were born. We can carry the search for the ultimate origin of ourselves back still further, back to the very beginning of the universe. Taking this broader cosmic perspective, we can appreciate more readily that the consciousness of the individual is inextricably tied to the consciousness of the whole." David Darling, Equations of Eternity, previously cited, page 22. I don't want to put words in Mr. Darling's mouth. As I understand his writing, he's referring only to our material brains, not to our premortal spirit existence with God. But the point is, our brains and bodies, too, aren't newly sprung into being. The material from which they are made is multi-billions of years old, and this mortal coming together of the two, known as birth and childhood, is a major milestone in our journey to become fully functioning, mature human beings, beings capable of functioning both with a coarse material universe and a spiritual or finer material cosmos. Darling, however, was dealing mainly with the differences between deconstructionism and seeing the whole. Darling writes, "There are, it seems, two essential complementary aspects to this cosmos. One is the whole, the indivisible, continuous, fluid unity, and the other is the interrelationship of parts in space and time. The brain has developed in such a manner as to take account of this dual aspect. And the reason is that the perception of both the whole and of its components is essential to survival, yet cannot be achieved simultaneously. You may be a mystic or a scientist, but you cannot be both at the same instant of time." Page 54. Much of the conflict between science and religion, or atheism and belief, I think, centers on the above duality. Deconstructionism, a philosophical way of looking at things that breaks everything down into its smallest component parts and tosses out anything that is irrational or can't be interpreted scientifically, is a great tool for many scientific studies, but falls short when considering God and the cosmos. I once had a discussion with an atheist over the God spot, as mentioned above in the brain. He said he'd dissected human brains in the laboratory and never came across a God spot. Well, no, one probably wouldn't. Nor did he come across Beethoven's Fifth or Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Deconstructionism doesn't take into account emergent properties and the sum of the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. In the introduction, I quoted Stephen Gould to the effect that science is tied into habits of deconstructionism and quite routinely misses the overall picture. The fact that there are many other things going on at the same time, and they all tie in together. Darling says we can't be both a mystic and scientist at the same time, but when we are done being one, it behooves us to be the other so we can get the whole picture. That's what I try to do in this book, anyway. But back to Darling and his writing on the human brain. Its development in the womb mirrors this duality. The development of the brain begins with the more primitive parts of the hindbrain and midbrain, and then proceeds to the regions associated with higher thought. That is as true of each emergent individual in the womb today as it was of the neurological development of life in general. We acquire, by stages, a spinal cord, a brain stem, a midbrain, a lizard-like brain, a mammalian brain, and, lastly, an advanced hominid brain, layer upon layer, working out. David Darling previously cited page 15. Our fetal development to fully functioning human recapitulates evolution in general, pages 26 through 27, and also, I think, our premortal choices to advance from primitive life forms to human, as stated in an earlier chapter. In a very real sense, our brains were preparing while our spirits were. Carl Sagan's famous comment about us being made from star stuff is true. The atoms of our mortal bodies went through their processes at the same time we were learning in the kingdom of heaven how to be mature spiritual beings after the patterns of our heavenly parents. Darling, referring to our material brain half, previously cited, puts it thus, in giving birth to us, the universe has performed its most astonishing creative act. It has fashioned intelligence and consciousness. Some of those tiny primordial pinpoints of matter from the infant cosmos have become temporarily arranged to make your brain and mine. Your thoughts at this very moment derive from energy transactions between particles born at the dawn of time. Roman numeral 13. Another function of her mind is memory. Betty Eady's near-death experience taught her that, quote, thoughts and experiences in our lives are recorded in our subconscious minds. They are also recorded in our cells, so that not only is each cell imprinted with the genetic coding, it is also imprinted with every experience we have ever had. Further, I understood that these memories are passed down through the genetic coding to our children. These memories then account for many of the passed-on traits in families, such as addictive tendencies, fears, strengths, and so on. Embraced by the Light, page 93. A major percentage of the DNA chain is unused for reproduction. Could it be our memories? According to Wired magazine, February 2007, page 113, quote, a typical human cell contains more than 6 feet of tightly cornrowed DNA, but only about an inch of that carries the codes needed to make proteins. What's the other 71 inches? If non-coding DNA were just along for the ride, it would rapidly incorporate mutations. But long stretches of non-coding DNA have remained basically the same for many millions of years. They must be doing something. End quote. Or might it be in our mitochondrial DNA? That comes from our mothers, and everyone knows women have better memories than men. In a sense, this causes me to doubt. To say that our DNA is changed with every memory is a bit Lamarckian. Our genes are pretty much set in concrete as far as passing on hereditary traits, but the article is referencing mainly DNA involved in reproduction. Perhaps the DNA stays the same for that, but the unused portion, that's 71 inches, might be flexible to encode memories. On the other hand, I'm neither a geneticist or biologist, so this is just an off-the-cuff guess. An interesting experiment. Follow the DNA patterns of a group of volunteers over a series of years and see if any of their coding does change. If so, that would be the coding for memory, or at least it could be. According to Wired, above, only 1 inch is actively used to pass on physical hereditary traits. Maybe the other 71 inches could be observed for changes. DNA is routinely read now. It shouldn't be that hard to experiment on. Easy for me to say. I've just postulated 71 times as much work as normal for someone, not me, who would have to do it. And here will be a major Nobel Prize in the 21st century. It goes to the person who figures out how to decode these cellular memories and translate them into a printout of our entire lives. Our memories are faulty, even of most recent events. It would be wonderful to tap into that cellular memory to get things right. That would be an incredible crime-solving tool, too. Way more effective than DNA evidence, which will be as ancient as fingerprints when this is put into practice. And think of the marriage squabbles it will solve. Wives will demand a cellular memory sample from their husbands every time an argument occurs, and, as usually happens, will more than likely be proven right. This is something we have to oppose, guys. But I digress, as I promised to do at the beginning. This isn't a complete fancy on my part, nor is it original with me. Some believe it's possible that a message to humans might be encoded on the DNA of a virus and is just waiting for us to decode it. In Lonely Places, David Grinspoon writes, as concerns aliens trying to contact us, quote, "One problem with radio or light rays is that they just flash through a system. The message does not stick around. So someone there has to be paying attention. If Earth had been bombarded with a continuous radio broadcast from a nearby star for 100 million years, ending in 1903, we would have completely missed it. For a permanent message that could only be read by a technologically advanced civilization, quote, it has even been proposed that the genomes of living organisms might have been designed with hidden messages waiting for us to develop the requisite biotechnology to decode them. A message from extraterrestrials might be hidden in the DNA of a virus that infects the common intestinal bacteria E. coli. As outlandish as this sounds, the genetic code contains some bizarre and unexplained patterns that seemed as if they could conceivably represent a message of some kind." End quote, page 324. We think our world has been completely mapped and explored. We haven't even scratched the surface. There's a relationship between mind and spirit that I think we need to explore here. Some religious fundamentalists, catering to people too lazy to think, perhaps, minimize or try to do away with the importance of the mind. Granted, it's not that we'll find out all the secrets of the cosmos just by thought alone. There are things that the rational mind just can't comprehend that need to be revealed to us, as I believe the theory of relativity was revealed to Einstein, such as time dilation when approaching the speed of light, which makes no sense at all, especially in light of Newton's very rational and insightful discoveries of the mechanical laws, sublight speed, of the universe. But rational thinking is needed, like the first stage of a multi-stage rocket, to get us up and running and headed for the cosmos. Reading Will and Ariel Durant's The Age of Napoleon, I came across this observation on the working and combining of mind and heart from Mademoiselle de Stael, a famous salonnière and author of the Napoleonic era. quote, "The growth of the intellect is not enough. Knowledge is only one element in understanding. The other is feeling. There must be a sensitivity of the soul as well as of the senses. Without it, the soul would be a tabula mortua, a dead receiver of physical sensations. With it, the soul enters into the life of other living beings, shares their wandering and suffering, feels the soul within the flesh, the God behind the material world." Page 290. In this, we see three elements of the human package: heart, mind, and community. In my words, therefore, it takes mind and heart, intellect, knowledge, and feeling to achieve the goal of understanding. In a series of lectures put out by the teaching company, Professor Daniel Robinson gives us insight into the mind-spirit relationship. Quote, "And I would lay great stress on the relationship in any society and civilization between the authority conferred on religious figures and the philosophical vitality of that age. If you are fairly satisfied that the most burning questions, the questions that are most insistent on your mind, are best answered by going to an authority, a named person, someone who holds the office of answering questions of life's meaning, if you've got that kind of arrangement, I submit that the philosophical dimensions of the culture will be fairly thin and fragile, if present at all. There is something about philosophy that is at once humanizing and utterly human. It's the court of last recourse. When the oracles have failed us, when the saints have grown silent, and when God has chosen not to reveal himself, then we stand back in the dark, dark shadows of confusion and fear and ask, what sort of being am I? What kind of life is right for me? And how should I govern or be governed?" The teaching company transcript, The Great Ideas of Philosophy, Professor Daniel N. Robinson, Part 1 of 5, pages 32 through 33. He doesn't advocate doing away with the spiritual dimensions of life, just a working relationship between the two, philosophy and spirituality. For purposes of our discussion here, I would say mind and heart. As he continues, previously cited, "So there is much to the peculiar relationship, then, between a religious outlook, which is coextensive with the human experience, and a vital ingredient in any life. A life devoid of the spiritual dimension is a life that has been emptied of one of the greatest sources of its activity and its devotion and motivation. The philosopher doesn't enter the arena of philosophy as one devoid of belief, one devoid of values, one devoid of hope and purpose and plan, aspirations, goals, and the like. No, all of that is in place. But there are those rare moments, then, where we say, no matter how much this means to me, no matter how centered my being is on this pattern of beliefs, no matter how close I am personally and emotionally and even romantically to those who hold these convictions, I am going to be skeptical about those statements. I am going to plumb the depths of those arguments to see, finally, what their truth value is." End quote. He concludes by relating how Socrates told of our relationship to the gods, how they have strings to control us like puppets, but we're not totally under their domination. We have one golden string on which we can pull back, and that is the string of reason. Quote, "It doesn't mean we can oppose the gods. It means we can resist a bit. We can make some way ourselves. We are not simply foils. Lose that reason. Suspend that criticality. Become gullible. Become credulous. Accept anything that custom serves up, and you are a puppet on a string, and the form of life you are living is the life of a slave." End quote, previously cited. God has given us our minds to use, and it is the constructive use of this resource that we complete one quarter of the command to love him with all our heart, might, mind, and strength. There's a saying that life is a gift of God to us. What we do with it is our gift to him. I would also say that our mind is a gift of God to us, and what we do with it is also a gift to him. Isaiah in the Old Testament quotes God as saying, "Come now and let us reason together." Isaiah chapter 1, verse 18. This tells me God himself wants us to use the gift of a reasoning mind, and he'll go along with us as we do so, adding any spiritual heart insight as we go. I promised in the introduction that I wouldn't be proselytizing for the LDS Church. I'm going to bump up against that promise here, but I feel I must tell the story. Many think that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is fundamentalistic and authoritarian in nature, that we have an authority figure. We do. The man at the head of our church is respected as a prophet of God to us, the equivalent of the Old and New Testament prophets, and we look to him as a source of wisdom and counsel. And therefore, some non-Mormons claim free thought isn't encouraged or developed. Okay, here's a Mormon joke. A member has a difficult question, so he asks his home teachers, people in the ward congregation, assigned to visit members and help them with problems, for an answer. They're stumped, but agree to take it to their superior, the elders' quorum president. He can't figure it out, so he goes to the head of the congregation, the bishop, who in turn can't find an answer and agrees to go to the stake president. No answer from him, but he takes it to the next level, the area president, archbishop, if you want a conventional term, who also is flummoxed and bumps it up one level to the 12 apostles. They aren't able to come up with an answer, so they take it to the first presidency. They decide they'd better ask the prophet for an answer, and do so. The prophet thinks for a minute and decides he'd better ask God for a revelation to handle this. God thinks for a minute, then says, "Well, that's his problem, isn't it?" As a lifelong member of this religion, I will just say that coming up with our own testimonies as to the truth of this religion is greatly emphasized, beginning with the promise in the Book of Mormon that encourages us to obtain our own witness of its validity. Reference Book of Mormon, page 529. Okay, enough of that. The powers and abilities of the human mind are largely untapped. It is said we use only 10% of it. I'd be surprised if it's that much. Alexander Solzhenitsyn writes of how he put his mind to work while in a Soviet prison camp. He had no desk on which to write, no privacy. His pencils or scraps and paper could be easily searched, and if the whiff of anything anti-Soviet caught the guard's suspicions, he could have wound up with a new prison sentence. So he learned to commit everything to memory. I find memorizing difficult enough, but imagine writing whole novels and having them stored only in memory. He put together a string of beads that would easily be mistaken for a rosary and used them as a counting system to secure every line. Quote, "I decided to write snatches of 12 to 20 lines at a time, polish them, learn them by heart, and burn them. I made it a firm rule not to content myself with tearing up the paper." End quote. He also made a set of matches, rather like an abacus of tens and ones, and fingered them as he went over his lines. As I recited the verses to myself, I displaced one bit of broken match from the units row for every line. When I had shifted 10 units, I displaced one of the tens. Every 50th and every 100th line I memorized with special care to help me keep count. Once a month I recited all that I had written. If the wrong line came out in place of one of the hundreds or fifties, I went over it all again and again until I caught the slippery fugitives. End quote. By the end of his sentence, he had accumulated 12,000 lines. Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, pages 99 through 101. I know as I write this book, thoughts come to me sometimes in the most inconvenient of times, such as while driving a truck and you can't write anything down. I try to memorize a key word and write it down later, hoping I'll recall the entire thought from this memory jog. Sometimes I don't, and a thought that might have made this a better work is lost. I stand in slack-jawed awe at Solzhenitsyn's accomplishments. I stated earlier that the development of the mind was important. This is one way we have of loving God with all of our mind. Professor Hugh Nibley previously cited, Nibley on the Timely and the Timeless, pages 265 through 266, writes of our responsibility to develop our intellects. Quote, "What is wrong with TV? Just this, that it shuts out all the wonderful things of which the mind is capable, leaving it drugged in a state of thoughtless stupor. We must think, but what about? The substance of thought is knowledge. The human brain depends for its normal alertness, reliability, and efficiency on a continuous flow of information about the world. The brain craves for information as the body craves for food." In defense of TV, Nibley wrote this before the cable era, which does have some intellectually excellent programming as far as I'm concerned. Nibley goes on to quote Joseph Smith, quote, "The mind or intelligence which man possesses is co-eternal with God himself. All the minds and spirits that God ever sent into the world are susceptible of enlargement. This is a very important purpose to this enlargement." Joseph Smith also taught, quote, "We consider that God has created man with a mind capable of instruction and a faculty which may be enlarged in proportion to the heed and diligence given to the light communicated from heaven to the intellect, and that the nearer man approaches perfection, the clearer are his views and the greater his enjoyments, till he has overcome the evils of his life and lost every desire for sin, and like the ancients, arrives at that point of faith where he is wrapped in the power and glory of his Maker and is caught up to dwell with him." End quote. In another place, Joseph Smith stated flatly, "It is impossible for a man to be saved in ignorance," and "The glory of God is intelligence," which is the motto of Brigham Young University. Doctrine and Covenants, sections 131, verse 6, and section 93, verse 36. Joseph Smith, founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was more concerned about the development of the mind than most religious leaders, it would seem to me. Consider this quote, "The things of God are of deep import, and time and experience and careful and ponderous and solemn thoughts can only find them out. Thy mind, O man, if thou wilt lead a soul unto salvation, must stretch as high as the utmost heavens, and search into and contemplate the darkest abyss and the broad expanse of eternity. Thou must commune with God. How much more dignified and noble are the thoughts of God than the vain imaginations of the human heart? None but fools will trifle with the souls of men." End quote. He goes on to condemn his fellow saints first of all. "How vain and trifling have been our spirits, our conferences, our councils, our meetings, our private as well as public conversations. Too low, too mean, too vulgar, too condescending for the dignified characters of the called and chosen of God." End quote. History of the Church, Volume 3, pages 295 through 296. "These things come neither easily nor quickly." Quote, "The conditions of God's kingdom are such that all who are made partakers of that glory are under the necessity of learning something respecting it previous to their entering into it." Teachings of the Prophet Joseph Smith, page 51. Jesus himself mentioned previously grew in wisdom. He didn't just come into it all at once at birth. Joyce H. Brown's book, previously cited, speaks to the importance of the mind-spirit connection. Quote, "I realized that my mind was powerful, but it was also my servant, a part of my earthly body given to me to use wisely. I was in charge. I could have taken command of my thinking and my attitudes. I could have worked at keeping my mind on things I wanted instead of on things I worried about. On earth, I could have reprogrammed my thinking because I was a child of God. Self-worth and personal power, I learned, are not a result of looking or acting a certain way or achieving a certain amount. They come from knowing and remembering the truth. I am a child of God." End quote. Page 113. "I see in the scripture that God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth." John chapter 4, verse 24. The spirit part of our worship of God is that spirit mentioned above. The truth part is the rational mind and the truths it learns and stores. God, through John, asks us to use both faculties in our worship of him. Francis Collins, the scientist in charge of the Human Genome Project and a religious person, combines science or truth slash mind in the context of the above with worship. Quote, God can hardly be threatened by the efforts of our puny minds to understand the grandeur of his creation. Science can be a form of worship. Indeed, believers should seek to be in the forefront among those chasing after new knowledge. The Language of God, previously cited, page 230. He goes on to quote Copernicus, who proved that the earth was not the center of the universe. Quote, to know the mighty works of God, to comprehend his wisdom and majesty and power, to appreciate in degree the wonderful workings of his laws, surely all this must be a pleasing and acceptable mode of worship to the Most High, to whom ignorance cannot be more grateful than knowledge. Page 230-231. Will Durant, The Pleasures of Philosophy, previously cited, page 183-184, ties some of these aspects together, specifically body and mind. Let me just quote at random. Quote, what specifically must one do to win mental and moral strength? Seek health first. The first requisite of a gentleman is to be a perfect animal. Since we cannot choose proper ancestors, we can at least choose proper diet and habits. There is no universal nostrum here. Each man must discover his own poisons and avoid them. Keep your bowels open and your mouth shut. This is the gamut of wisdom. Nature made us to move about, to lift weights and run and climb. She fashioned us for a life of arms and legs. The ideal career would combine physical with mental activity in unity or alteration. To seek health and strength, we may need a new environment, and it is always a consolation to reflect that we can alter our situation. We shall not change ourselves substantially unless we change the stimuli that beat upon our flesh from hour to hour and form us at last in their image. Are we living amongst unclean people or illiterates, concerned only with material and edible things? Let us go off, whatever it may cost us, and seek better company. Better to listen to greatness than to dictate to fools. If, as you are likely to think, there is no greater one than you in the circle to which life narrows you, then make friends of genius in the past. For a penny you can buy their counsel and listen familiarly to their speech and mold yourself in the clear air which runs about them. There is no excuse for being small when we can sit at table with Napoleon or walk with Whitman or have midnight suppers with Frederick and Voltaire. And note three of the four elements, body, mind, and group. Durant above deftly ties in the relationship between body and mind and group. Dennis Prager makes good distinctions between mind and heart, or intellect and spirit. Quote, without detracting from the need for reason, which is invaluable to morality, and which too many religious people have insufficiently used, we have to recognize reason's moral limitations. 1. Reason can justify virtually any behavior. Reason does not demand moral behavior. Reason does not spur moral passion. The decision to be good is not a reason-based one. It is an act of faith. Prager, Think a Second Time, previously cited, page 224. He sums up the need for both. The belief that reason alone leads to morality is a secular myth, just as the belief that faith alone leads to morality is a religious myth, page 225. The last of the four aspects of humanity is that of group or strength, as previously defined. From Runes, Treasury of Philosophy, previously cited, we have the observations of French writer Jules Roman regarding the group aspect of humanity. Quote, I believe, in fact, that the adventure of humanity is essentially an adventure of groups. It is also an adventure of individuals in conflict with groups or with each other. The life of society at whatever level has always been considered important as a key to the explanation of human action. Page 997. Alan Watts, The Wisdom of Insecurity, page 121, confirms our group proclivities. Quote, "For among the things that give man pleasure are relations with other human beings, conversation, eating together, singing, dancing, having children, and cooperation in work which many hands make light. Indeed, one of the highest pleasures is to be more or less unconscious of one's own existence, to be absorbed in interesting sights, sounds, places, and people. Conversely, one of the greatest pains is to be self-conscious, to feel unabsorbed and cut off from the community and the surrounding world." End quote. Albert Schweitzer also commented on the relationships of the individual to the whole, an inescapable relationship to be sure. Runes, previously cited, page 1090 through 1. Quote, "Ethical conflicts between society and the individual continue to exist because the individual has not only a personal but also a supra-personal sense of responsibility. We all have the experience of being placed in positions where we are responsible not only for ourselves but also for some affair or business, and are then forced to make decisions which run counter to personal morality." He gives an example of a sympathetic employer having to fire a drunken worker, in spite of the feelings the employer may have for the hardships that will come to the worker's family. We can't escape the group aspect of our humanity, no matter how much we might wish. I think also there is a group accountability and judgment, call it group karma, if you will, which needs to be balanced or paid up. Example: most people decry the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan to end World War II. I see it as payback for Japanese atrocities against unarmed civilian populations in China, Nanking specifically, French Indochina, the Pacific Islands, and the Philippines. I won't go into detail, but the rape of Nanking is how that particular episode is referred to, and very few people know its black and grim history. The Japanese have yet to recognize their actions there and apologize. At least the Germans have tried to face up to and deal with their atrocities of the war years. Of course, we didn't bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki specifically for payback, but I believe the cosmos judged the Japanese people in general, and the account was squared when the Enola Gay and Boxcar dropped their bombs. Yes, scores of thousands of innocent Japanese died in these blasts. Men, women, children, the elderly, those who had no part in their countrymen's actions above mentioned. But the same may be said of faultless Chinese and Filipinos. Their guiltless blood was required by the cosmos to be paid for, and the innocent blood of the Japanese in Hiroshima and Nagasaki was the price. In the long run, the atomic bombings of those cities also saved many more Japanese lives that would have been lost in an invasion, not to mention Allied lives. A further benefit to come from these bombings: Russia entered the war at that point. Imagine a few years later a communist North Japan pitted against a free South Japan. We think we had problems with North and South Korea and North and South Vietnam in the second half of the 20th century. Imagine the additional problems of a Japan divided North and South, communist and free. I'll probably never be popular supporting the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but I think in the long run it was about as good an outcome as could have been cobbled together for the Japanese and the Allies. Plus, their debt was paid. As far as our group relationships go, I think Paul expressed it best in his metaphor of the church being a body. For the body is not one member, but many. If the foot shall say, "Because I am not the hand, I am not of the body," is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear shall say, "Because I am not the eye, I am not of the body," is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where were the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where were the smelling? But now God hath set the members, every one of them, in the body, as it hath pleased him. End quote. 1 Corinthians 12:14-18, New Testament. Our roles might differ from group to group. In one will be the foot, in another the eye. In no group will we ever be the whole body, and in every group we'll have a part. I have used previously the metaphor of life being a jigsaw puzzle. Throughout your life, there will be people you just don't like. You can't see any reason for them to be part of the picture of life. Well, perhaps they won't be placed next to you in this puzzle. Maybe, with luck, they'll be placed way off in some other area where they can fit in. No one puzzle piece can say to any other, "You don't fit in this picture. You don't belong." And even if they do have to fit in next to you, it's something you'll have to learn to live with and say to yourself, as I have to say to myself on many occasions, they're part of the puzzle too, and I have to accept the fact that they have a legitimate place. Now, I will make an exception to those who are criminally minded, violent, and murderous. There is no place for them in our world, besides prison. Nor should we, out of misguided charity, try and make one for them. But the place they could have had can be easily taken up by others. Groups, sadly, can become mobs bent on unreasoning and passionate destruction if they are led by a dictator with no morals. Ralph Waldo Emerson, previously cited, writes in Compensation, quote, "A mob is a society of bodies voluntarily bereaving themselves of reason. The mob is man voluntarily descending to the nature of the beast. Its fit hour of activity is night. Its actions are insane. It persecutes a principle. It would whip a right, it would tar and feather justice by inflicting fire and outrage upon the houses and persons of those who have these. There are apparently soul groups in the premortal existence, and I feel it is these groups that come here as tribes, nationalities, or special interests, such as those African Americans and others who came together to fight for civil rights in the U.S. in the early 60s. There are many near-death experiences that lend credence to this idea, and I'll mention some as we go. I think as God sees the development of the human race, he prepares like-minded spirits to come together in one place at one time to change the course of history. The years 500 through 300 BC are known as the axial period, when the course of Earth's history swung into different directions. Buddhism and Confucianism brought philosophical religions to the East, Greek philosophy brought these great gifts to the West, and the Jews brought ethical monotheism to counter the pagan worship of multiple gods. No one person could have made such great changes to our world. It took several like-minded people coming together at once in certain places prepared for free-thinking individuals. Plans are man's, odds are God's. Like a strong bullpen waiting to bail the team out from a game where the other team is starting to score, God has in reserve like-minded individuals he can send in when things on earth get out of control and need changing. I think this is true for all aspects of our culture. In the late 19th and early 20th century, for example, great minds like Einstein, Planck, Schrödinger, Gell-Mann, Feynman, and others came together to bring us into the post-Newtonian age of physics. I'd even go so far as to say even such trivialities as baseball have their soul groups coming together. Think of the great 20s baseball era of Ruth, Gehrig, Cobb, Hornsby, and others who got that great game up and running. Those who think Earth is going to hell and there's no future aren't taking into account God's foreknowledge of our deteriorating situation and the reserves he has to bring things back around. The men and women who will lead us back from the abyss of nuclear terrorism, political cowardice, self-serving incompetence, and corporate greed and blindness are already among us, I feel, as babies and maybe children. I wish them luck and Godspeed in their difficult assignments. The most important group is, of course, the family. In summing up our family relationships from a near-death experience, Lindahl and Widdowson, The Eternal Journey, previously cited, draw these conclusions. Spirits can elect to join together and become families on Earth. They are aware of what is happening in their prospective families on Earth. Certain types of family atmospheres are preferable to others. Page 243. Betty Eady confirms that notion. Quote, "We had bonded together in the spirit world with certain spirit brothers and sisters, those we felt especially close to. My escorts explained that we covenanted with these spirits to come to Earth as family and friends." Quote, "And not just for the purpose of forming families, but also groups. We also chose to come to Earth with certain others because of the work we would do together. Some of us wanted to unite in a cause to change certain things on Earth, and we could best do it with certain circumstances brought about by selected parents or others." Embraced by the Light, pages 92, 93. Recently in the 20th century, when those who would become the Nazi Germans came to Earth to try their hand at power and authority. God also sent Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt as a counterbalance. The Nazi Germans had their agency to play out, to establish to the cosmos for all eternity just what kind of souls they were. But so their power wouldn't overwhelm the world and make it uninhabitable for decent, freedom-loving spirits, an opposition had to be sent as well. There must be opposition in all things. Churchill couldn't have won out against Hitler alone, nor could have Roosevelt. It was group against group, almost mirroring the original struggle in heaven over agency versus coercion. I think some groups can come together for evil purposes too, though they probably didn't think it would turn out that way. An example to me, as mentioned above, would be those who helped Hitler Nazify Germany and bring on the Holocaust. As dynamic and forceful as he was, he couldn't have accomplished all he did without willing and capable cohorts. I think, in the premortal world, when God recognized the Jews as advanced to the point where they could be counted on to lead the human race into ethical monotheism, as discussed previously, this particular group of people, future Nazis, protested, claiming that they ought to be entrusted with power and leadership, and if so, they could show God what they could do. Indeed, they did. God gave them the milieu and the means, and for all eternity, the entire cosmos now knows what people like Hitler, Himmler, Goering, and Goebbels will do with power and authority. They'll never have it again. Radical Muslims are currently in that same place, proving to God, as did the Nazi Germans, how they will use the power and the gifts Allah has given them. Now, lest some say I'm claiming that God fooled away the lives of 6 million Jews just to prove a point to a few Nazis, let me say that there is a purpose in all of his doings, and yes, even the Holocaust will have a satisfactory explanation in the eternities. I can only speculate on what that would be, and any speculation would seem cavalier indeed and insensitive to Jews, a people I greatly admire. So I won't go there, at least for now. I hope it suffices to affirm that I am most certainly not a Holocaust denier. 6 million innocent Jews were murdered for no other reason than race and religion, and it was a definite demonstration of humanity's inhumanity at its lowest level. As to an explanation of the Holocaust in terms of an eschatological outlook, we'll save it for a later chapter. And now in our time, the 21st century, we have the sole group of radical Islamo-fascists bent on destroying freedom. We who love freedom must strongly oppose them by whatever means we can muster. The original cosmic battle between freedom and slavery is still being fought, just on a different battlefield. As Yogi Berra was alleged to have said, it's deja vu all over again. The soul groups we formed in the previous existence may be described as tribal. Dr. Michael Newton, Destiny of Souls, previously cited, writes, soul groups do appear to be tribal in their intense loyalty and mutual support for each other in a spiritual community. However, soul groups are not tribal in their relationships toward other groups. Earth societies have a nasty habit of mistrusting one another at best and demonstrating bitterness and cruelty at worst. Societies in the spirit world are inclined to be rigorous, moderate, or compliant in their interpersonal relationships, but I see no evidence of discrimination or alienation either within or between soul groups. Souls strictly observe the sanctity of other groups. Page 192. In other words, they truly tolerate diversity. Newton continues with some insight into the soul group attitudes in the spirit world. Quote, soul groups appreciate individualism. It is expected that you will stand out and make contributions. There are forceful souls and quiet souls, but no one dominates, just as no one is obtrusive. Individualism is appreciated because each soul is unique, with strengths and weaknesses that complement others in the group. We are assigned to certain soul groups for our differences, as well as similarities, like Paul's analogy of the body. Unfortunately, that aspect seems to disappear with most groups here. One wonders where it goes. The four aspects of humanity are not completely separable, but function in harmony with each other and are affected negatively by weakness in any one of the other members. That four-legged stool will rock and be unstable if any of the legs is shorter than the others. When God asks us to be one, I think we must start with the four aspects of our nature and bring them into oneness. From there, we can begin to become one with others and ultimately with God and Christ. John 17:21-23, quote, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And the glory which thou gavest me, I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one. I in them, and thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one. Thus we have the four aspects of our human nature, with which we are commanded to love God in a fullness, with all of each one. This, however, doesn't complete the catalogue of our natures, as if any chapter in a book could. We must also consider feminine and masculine differences, as well as the combining of the two in marriage, where two individuals are commanded to be one. Genesis 2:24. We'll get at least half of that, the better half, in the next chapter. And thus we conclude this 15th podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Becoming Female, and we'll deal with the 8th chapter. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in. And special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com, that's HAZELLEPRODUCTIONS.com. Thank you.